Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Merrick vs. Wyszynski podcast for a Tuesday, September...
You know, what were you going to announce there? There's a big announcement about the 10-year anniversary of the lockout of 2004-05. Is that what you were getting at there?
September 16th. No, I was just stating the date and the name of the show for anybody who may have, you know, randomly tuned in they were downloading a bunch of podcasts. They didn't really know what was going on. They came across ours, and I was merely stating the name of the show and the date so people would know exactly what they were looking at.
You know, it's a good point because when this podcast goes in the podcast wing of the Hockey Hall of Fame, it's going to need some timestamps. So we might want to start timestamping the show before we start everything. You know what just sort of dawned on me? Because Wish and I call into the fan, I don't know, 5-10 minutes before the show starts just to make sure that the lines work. And sometimes when they work, they don't actually work, as we've heard before here on this podcast, sometimes halfway through, sometimes right at the beginning. But you know what we should just start doing? Why don't we just start the show when we call in?
And what? And just start, and then just start rambling?
Yeah, like, why don't you just make that part of the show? That's like the green room before the show actually starts. And then Brant or Maddie will count us down, and then we'll be off to the real show.
All it will be will
kind of give like it like a David Steinberg sort of Gary Shandling kind of vibe.
I know, I feel you on that. I tend to believe, though, that maybe it would be like the first 15 or so minutes of Mark Maron's podcast where I just kind of like... Skip ahead 30 seconds, skip ahead 30 seconds, skip ahead 30 seconds. Oh, here's Claire Danes. You like get to the guest or the part of the show that you really want to hear and avoid the rest of it is I think how that would probably work.
All right.
But I heard somebody today say that it was the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the 2004 lockout. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but we're going to treat it as such. It's time to revisit.
Hang on, what day is it? Yeah, 16th, because... World Cup of Hockey ended on the 15th, and the next day was going to be lockout day. It was a big celebration with that ugly frickin' trophy, and the next day the padlocks were going on. So I think that's right. Because the CBA would have expired September 15th. So yes, today is day, you're right. Today is day, it would have been day one of the great darkness that was 04-05.
We're going to take a look back at it today for a little bit because it is the great darkness. Did we get a guest or no? No guest?
I emailed and texted Dobigan, but he hasn't got back to me. He would have been the perfect guest, but he hasn't got back to me. Maybe he'll – listen, man, he's a good last-minute guy too. Like if he texts back in like 2 seconds, says, yeah, I can hop on, like dude will hop on.
Right. It was a couple of things to right off the bat. First off, I remember the 2004 Stanley Cup Final between Tampa Bay and Calgary. It had sort of this – dancing at the end of the world vibe to it. There was this dark cloud hanging over this whole thing, being like, enjoy it while you can, folks. It's not going to be, you're not going to see this for a while. And pretty much that was depressing because the series was terrible, if memory serves. Wasn't it
so terrible? It was awful. Your lingering memory, your last memory of that season is going to be Ruslan Fedotenko scoring 2 goals in that final game.
Exactly.
That was going to be it. That's what you had to hang on to for a year.
There was one great fight, the Le Cavalier fight that will go down in history as, oh, hey, look, everybody, stars fight. But the whole thing had this vibe of like, you know, it was like when you pass by a carpet store that's been going out of business for the last year, and now everything's marked down to 95% off, and it's the last day that they're open, and it's just two Middle Eastern guys having beers in the back waiting for someone to wander in and buy that thing that looks like a checkerboard on LSD. It's that vibe. That was how the NHL Stanley Cup Final that year felt.
That was it for you because were you a World Cup guy that year? Did you watch World Cup of Hockey at all? Because that whole tournament had that vibe to me because I knew that, you know, Stanley Cup Final, you know, Tampa-Calgary is going to be the last NHL that we saw for a while, but the last, quote-unquote, hockey in North America at an elite level, apologies, American Hockey League, was going to be the World Cup of Hockey. And I think that was our first chance. If I can recall, that was our first chance at seeing Alexander Ovechkin as a quasi-pro.
Right.
I mean, he had been in Halifax for the World Junior Tournament. The Grand Forks Tournament was still coming up. That was the 05 under-20s. But that was the first time, I think, that we saw Alexander Ovechkin as a quasi-pro in North America. I remember watching him warm up. He did this like little passing drill with Ilya Kovalov and, oh, God, who was it? Oh, Frolov. Remember him? Oh, man, he's good in that tournament,
wow,
too.
Wow, Alex Frolov.
Yeah,
geez.
That's right, and he was in that tournament. And they did this passing drill and warm-up that was, like, right out of what you would have seen at, like, Joe Louis Arena when the Red Army rolled through in 1976, where everybody kind of went, huh? These guys can do what with this little black thing that all we're doing is sort of advancing forward 5 feet at a time. And I thought to myself, man, this is going to be the most wicked hockey player we've ever seen in the NHL. And for a while he was. But that to me was like, that was the bittersweet tournament because you knew it was coming the next day. Even though, and I can't get either side to confirm this, nor do I ever believe that they will, but there is that belief that before the lockout happened, both Bill Daly, congratulations on the Lester Patrick, by the way, Mr. Daly.
Oh, yeah.
And Ted Saskin had worked out an agreement and both presented it to Mr. Bettman and Mr. Goodenow, respectively, and were shot down. And they did that at Hurley's in Montreal, which is why whenever you go to Montreal, if you've ever gone to Montreal and you've never gone to a Habs game, A, do it, and B, go have a beer at Hurley's. Because
Hurley's
there's a lot of
great
hockey history, a lot of hockey history at Hurley's.
Yeah, that was actually one of my favorite moments with anybody that I've ever met was at Hurley's. I believe it was at Hurley's, where me and the folks from Pension Plan Puppets were having beers, and my friend Kemi, he came over and bought a copy of my book, Glow Pucks and 10 Cent Beer, the 101 Worst Ideas in Sports History. He bought over a copy of my book and had me autograph it, and whilst I was autographing informed me that he had purchased it for a penny on Amazon. And so I think I wrote that into maybe he'll tweet it out later. I wrote that into the message, the fact that he bought the book for a penny. You know, I make no bones about the fact that I'm usually a player's guy in these debates, and these labor kerfuffles. By the way, in thinking back to 2004-2005, I understand why we all had PTSD about it whenever we go into another lockout or anything. The amount of vitriol, the absolute strap on your boots and put on your helmet war that went on between those two sides of that season was incredible if you look back on it. The vitriol, the anger, the demonization of everybody, the traitorous behavior by people from one side to the other. It was insane what happened. Oh, it was insane.
It was nuts. It was the night of the long knives, especially in the Players Association when Goodenow got knifed.
Ooh. I'll say this about the players' proposal. I was at the time a luxury tax guy. I thought that system could work. I liked the idea of the strong teams remaining strong. I'm always a fan of teams that develop their own talent, being able to retain their own talent. The idea that a team like Detroit would have had to shed players or shed talent just because they had the nerve to draft well and sign well and develop the right players really kind of irked me. I think the league is better when it has strong franchises for a good amount of time and not just like a new champion each year. I think that's not good for hockey. I think good for hockey is going into the next season knowing that the Kings are good and the Blackhawks are good and the Bruins are good and the Penguins are good and the Blues might be good and San Jose might be good and then we fill in the blanks. Like, I'm really okay with that. And I felt that the salary cap might be something that gets in the way of that from happening.
But we're there now.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's the thing. We're there now. Like all those teams, like it's not the way that the NHL positioned it was every year at the beginning of the season, it's going to be jump ball for the Stanley Cup. Well, no, it's not. It's not jump ball for the Stanley Cup. And by and large, it is. We're seeing the same faces, the same teams every season. There's a couple of teams that sort of pop up, but they get, you know, they turn into whack-a-mole by the second round of the NHL playoffs.
And I've often said that the NHL success post-lockout has been a series of happy accidents. And one of them is the fact that the salary cap allowed for this thing to still happen and allowed for the very teams that I thought would have to use luxury tax in order to keep their teams together to somehow keep their teams. Like, there's no way back in 2005 I thought a team like Chicago could exist. And they might not. I mean, they still have to probably get rid of Patrick Sharp after this year. But they've kept that talent along the way pretty well. But what the miracle thing is, though, for some of these teams, and Chicago's the prime example, is it's not if there wasn't a salary cap, Bufflin would still be there. Versteeg would still be there. All the guys that they had to shed, Brian Cant, all the guys they had to shed after their first cup because of the cap, some of them might still be there. But so what it did essentially is you can keep your core, you just have to trim around the edges, And then the difference between the Blackhawks and other teams, and the Penguins, I think, are the best example of this, is how good are you at augmenting that core with the right players to make another run at it. And that's the difference between the Penguins and the Blackhawks. The Blackhawks jettisoned a ton of dead weight after that cup from a salary cap perspective. And then it took them about a season or two to figure out the right mix. They found the right mix. They had some kids come up like Saad, and then they won another cup. The Penguins, over time, had to expunge basically everybody in their bottom six and some other good role players, and they've yet to figure out the formula again. And that's really what the salary cap, I think, did for those really, well, really good teams.
Drafting well helps, and you might say, listen, when you're dealing with 18-year-olds, you kind of get a sense of where they're going to be when they're 25, but you really don't. You have a good shot at where they're going to be in the if you draft them in the first round, but after that, it gets a little bit trickier. And Chicago has been good slash maybe you could say lucky with a lot of those bottom six guys that have been able to fill in. Like with all those guys you mentioned that got jettisoned, you know, all of a sudden, hey, you know, here comes Andrew Shaw. Who saw Andrew Shaw excelling at the NHL level? And I watched Andrew Shaw all through junior. I never thought he was going to be this good in the NHL. Not a chance. Marcus
really?
Kruger, did you? For Shaw, no way. Really good OHL player, legend in Owen Sound, loved him. Never thought he was going to be that good at the NHL, at the NHL level. I thought, just may go down as a really good American Hockey League player, really good in junior, but not going to work in the NHL. Yeah.
If I may, the legend of Owen Sound is the best unreleased Rush song I've ever conceived, by the way.
Right next to Vitor and the Snow Dog. And Ben Smith, right? Like, there's a lot of these guys, right? Jeremy Morin. Like, I saw it as obviously the best example, because he's been able to step in as a second round pick and show that he can play with superstars like Jonathan Taves and Marian Hossa. But that's the story of the Blackhawks. Good at drafting, lucky at drafting. Take your pick. Whereas the Pittsburgh Penguins, there's a lot of really good defensemen on the horizon for the Pittsburgh Penguins. If you want to compare the two teams, there's a lot of good blue liners out there. But to your point, Wish, they haven't been able to fill in those bottom players at all, right? It's this, and now it's a revolving door of Nick Spaulding and Steve Downey and Marcel Gotch and Blake Como. It's
trying to figure it out.
It continues to be that revolving door of the bottom six.
I was a luxury tax guy. I thought it could work. I thought it was a handy way to redistribute the wealth in the league, the socialist that I am. I'm not really a socialist, but it's fun to talk about it that way because I know it's such a scary word. So I thought that was a handy way to
tax
do
the
it. Allow the rich to spend as much as they want and then have it go get kicked back to the weaker teams in the league. And then you maintain the power structure of juggernaut teams and teams you care about. And other teams get to, you know, reach the salary floor. It didn't work out that way. I think the salary cap has been, by and large, now that it's linked to revenue and revenue has surged, it's been a good thing. If the league's coffers weren't filled by things like television contracts and outdoor games, I might feel differently about it. But I think it's at a place now where teams aren't having to make scorched earth decisions about the talent that they draft and develop. They can maintain a lot of it and jettison only a few players every season.
I'm probably the wrong guy to say this because I grew up in an era of dynasty teams. Like my introduction to hockey as, you know, a young boy growing up was, you know, it seems like those two Philadelphia Flyers squads that won the Stanley Cup, that Montreal Canadiens team in the late 70s, that team, the four in the row for the Islanders, the dynasty that were the Edmonton Oilers, that Pittsburgh Penguins squad. Like, I grew up with measuring stick teams. That's the hockey that I knew. So,
yeah,
I've always felt that hockey is a sport that needs a measuring stick team, a dynasty team,
completely,
a team that can rattle off two or three. But the thing is about that, is I really need to check myself on that because am I just saying that because I believe it or is that what I grew up with? I don't know. Like if you're if you've been a fan of hockey, like let's say you're a fan of hockey since the 2005 lockout. Do you think, I'm asking you, do you think that this league needs a measuring stick team that wins two or three Stanley Cups in a row? Or do you like the idea of every year a new team gets its name scratched on the Stanley Cup? Because I'm not sure whether I'm just talking because of my own history with the game or if I really believe it.
I think that answer might be different for people depending on what team they pull for. If you're a fan of a small market team, that can't necessarily compete with Chicago and Boston and L.A. as far as the revenues and the amount of money they can spend on talent, you might feel differently about it. But for me, like, I look at every sport that I enjoy, and it is that dynamic that I enjoy most, which is to have the big dog at the top of the mountain everybody's trying to knock down. You know, whether it's boxing, whether it's wrestling, the best times in wrestling are when you have some monster heel or some monster babyface that everybody's trying to take down. The Hogan run in the 1980s is what defined wrestling, was everybody going up and here's the next challenger and now he knocks him down. They repeated that formula again and again, and John Cena was the last guy to get that formula applied to him. The NFL, Major League Baseball with the Yankees and Red Sox, all of these places are better places when there is one, two, three franchises that you can use as measuring sticks. And the best example of it for today in the National Hockey League is the Boston Bruins. Imagine how tedious and horrible the Eastern Conference would be right now were it not for the Boston Bruins being the team that everybody was gunning for, everybody was knuckling up to try to figure out how to take down. Like, they make the Eastern Conference much more interesting right now than if it was just a bunch of teams all around the same point level, all trying to make the playoffs every season.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's always been the copycat league. We've talked about that before. Do you think there are... Here's my question now, because you're right. Everyone has, in the last couple of years, gunned for the Boston Bruins. They wanted that model. Personally, I think it's a pretty macho model, and that's why I think a lot of general managers like to nut up and say, yeah, we want to play that Boston Bruins style hockey. Like, that's a man's game. That's how we play. But do you think teams out there right now are saying, okay, how do we beat the Los Angeles Kings? The same way they're saying, okay, how can we beat the Boston Bruins at their game? Oh, by the way, I'm just texting with Dobigan right now. He's joining us in a couple of minutes.
Sweet. I don't know. That's a great question. Because if you were going to beat the Los Angeles Kings, how would you beat them? Because they're a very interesting team in the sense that they can beat you several different ways. They can beat you with goaltending. They can beat you physically. They've got skill guys. Like,
well,
you know,
if I may get my Don Cherry on here. What you got to do is just got to get more OHL players than the Los Angeles Kings do. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Your Drew Doughtys and your Jeff Carters and your Mike Richards and your Tyler Toffolis and your Tanner Pearsons. Do I need to go on?
You need to match the Kings. Ontarian for Ontarian. No Russians. No Czechs. Ontarians. If your Ontarian count does not match that of the Los Angeles Kings, you might as well just pack it up and go home.
Who's that Slovak center they got? Oh, actually, he's Slovenian. Yeah, whatever.
Whatever. Tomato, tomato, McLean.
That's awesome.
No, that's a great point. I think that the Bruins are, there's always that one, and usually it's teams that exhibit that physicality, because when the Ducks won the Cup, when Brian Burke's Ducks won the Cup, and all of a sudden everybody tried to model themselves after that. The Minnesota Wild signed every tough guy in the league over the next couple of years to try to combat the Ducks model. It happens.
But everybody misread the Ducks. I mean, Ducks won because of, you know, more so because of Pronger and Niedermeyer than any kind of toughness, though.
Oh,
toughness,
God, right?
was part of their identity, but man, it's easier to win a Stanley Cup when you have two Hall of Famers on your blue line.
So to bring it back to lockout for a second, let me ask you this. When this thing started,
yep.
Did you think we'd lose a season?
Yep, I did. Yep, from day one, I thought because don't forget, the year before, Bob Goodenow was going around, and the questionnaire to the players was simple. A, do you want a salary cap? And universally, they said no. I said, well, okay, it's going to cost. Are you prepared to sit out for 1 year? Yes. Are you prepared to sit out for 2 years? The answer came back slower, but it was still yes. But then sometime right around, it was interesting too, because it was Ted Saskin and Bill Daly on Valentine's Day in Niagara Falls. Oh, how symbolically romantic, guys. Everything changed. Right? The players came off of their anti-salary cap stance. And it caught a lot of those guys with their pants down because they were doing radio interviews saying, I'm never going to play in a league with a salary cap. Oops, well, guess what your Players Association just did, and you didn't have a vote on it.
Right. The biggest mistake Goodenow made was during the negotiation where part of the players' package, if you remember, was the luxury tax, some other malarkey, and a 5% rollback on salaries. in order to try to negotiate and win on the luxury tax, Goodenow offered to bring it up to a 24% rollback on salaries, which indicated to the league that the union was willing to roll back salaries 24%. And guess what number was never mentioned after that? 5%.
Yeah.
He gave that away as a negotiating tactic, and then it became part and parcel to the NHL's proposals going forward.
It almost seems as if, you know, Bob Goodenow is in some ways playing a public relations game by rolling salaries back. Was it 24 or 26%?
It was 24, because I think.
It was 24. Because remember, there was that magic number that Gary said, we need to have players' salaries at this percentage. And with that rollback, they hit that percentage. And what the NHL did, as opposed to saying, which I don't know that Gary, that Bob Goodenow thought, you know, for 1 second, the NHL would say, okay, we have a deal. What the NHL did was they said, okay, we've got the players' percentage back to where we want it. Now we're going to start negotiating. And now we're going to take that, we're going to keep it on the table, and that stays. Thank you very much.
The essential thing with every lockout is this. The owners make their own mess. They bathe in their own bullshit. And that's the hardest thing for, I think, a lot of us to deal with, is that even if the end result is better for the game, and you could make the argument that the economic system they put in place, the salary cap, everything else that came out of that lockout is the foundation for what's come since, which is a boom for the National Hockey League.
Yeah.
It's still troublesome that the Bobby Holík contract happened and the Joe Sakic offer sheet happened. And all of this other stuff that led these guys down the road to handing out absurd amounts of money to players and then crying about it and shutting down a season to fix it. Like, it's hard for me still to stomach that being the catalyst for what we saw, even if what we saw was a necessity.
Yeah, the thing is, they own it, and that's their money. And if they want to shut it down to, quote-unquote, make it right, it's their league. It's their arenas, it's their infrastructure, it's their money, it's their businesses. Like, I'm with you, I'm more of a player's guy on all these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I know we keep hearing the old saying, it's billionaires versus millionaires, and fair is not a word that should exist in the dictionary. It's their league. Mm-hmm. It's their league. Those 30 governors and Gary Bettman, it's their league. They can offer sheet Joe Sakic and Sergei Fedorov, you know, up the wazoo. It was, try to screw Peter, you know, Peter Camano's trying to stick it to Mike Ilitch, and, you know, the Rangers trying to stick it to the Avs. But at the end of it all, it's their league. And if they say, you know what? Yeah, we've made some mistakes. So be it. Now we're going to clean up that mess we made. And you know what? It's our money, and we have the right to make another mess. And if it costs you a season, then that's your decision as a fan, whether you want to come back or not.
Back in the day, the union opposed the linkage between revenues and the salary cap, which I, looking back on it, find very interesting. And it shows that no one knew where this league was going. At the time, there was a malaise over the NHL. We were still coming out of the trap years. Ovechkin hadn't arrived yet. Sidney hadn't arrived yet. Nobody was playing outdoors. The new rules weren't in place to make the game more exciting than it had ever been, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So it just goes to show, if they had the pensive from Harry Potter, where they would look into it and see the future, or maybe you see the past in there, I forget. If they could see the future, Merrick, the point is, is that they would probably have welcomed linkage to revenue, wouldn't they have?
I know, because I think it forces players into areas where they can't say no, where they can't push back, because now all they're concerned about is making as much money as possible. They can't get it by way of salary, and they want to minimize the amount of escrow that they pay. So there will be no pushback if advertising goes on jerseys, because players will get a percentage of it.
Right.
They can't do
anything that would potentially harm a revenue stream or potentially interrupt the season, for example, or else it comes out of their pockets.
You go along with it. And you know what? You go along with things that may end up putting you in potentially dangerous situations. Like, you remember the Winter Classic between the Washington Capitals and the Pittsburgh Penguins? I'm still shocked
not at all.
Yeah, it wasn't that big a deal. Steckel meets Crosby's head. I'm still shocked that the Players Association allowed that game to be played. I am stunned. Yeah. But part of me says, well, if they didn't, that's money out of their pockets. Like, if there wasn't, if linkage didn't exist, and there was more of a traditional relationship between an ownership group and its union, I would be shocked if any other sport, if the players' association of that sport allowed their players to go on the ice in that situation. The ice was bad enough as it was. You add rain, you add different angles, you add a weird environment at a high speed. I'm surprised, and it cost the game its greatest star. I'm surprised that the Players Association said, yeah, go ahead, play the game, boys. Or even just didn't stop it halfway through. And I wonder in the back of my head whether that is the Players Association saying, you know what, we can't submarine this thing because, man, we're looking at 15% escrow here. We got to make this money back.
Right, right. Yeah. It's and again, like I said, I think that you could point to a lot of the stuff that came out of the lockout and say that was the foundation for some good things that happened for the league. But at the same time, I will also accept the argument that nothing the lockout did was as important as Sidney Crosby, as Alex Ovechkin, as the way that the Shanahan Commission made these new rules, which you could say is a byproduct of the lockout, but at the same time, it might have happened anyway.
Canadian dollar was a big one.
Canadian dollar, Winter Classic, perhaps more importantly than anything else, the return to prominence for some very important franchises in some very important cities. The Chicago Blackhawks, the Philadelphia Flyers, the Pittsburgh Penguins, the Boston Bruins. I mean, congratulations, lockout. You did a good job setting the dominoes up. But if it ain't for the fact that if we came out of the lockout in the next, 7 or 8 years of dominance were the Ottawa Senators and, the Florida Panthers. You think the NHL will be where they are now? They are where they are now because glamour franchises became glamorous again. And people start talking about hockey in big cities.
NHL has been pretty lucky. Been pretty lucky with the Stanley Cup finals that they've had. Like, look at last year. New York and Los Angeles. Holy smokes. Who can blink in the NHL office? Nobody. And the Rangers and Kings went through. No one.
Thanks to Julie, Eliza, and Tally, by the way, for pointing out that the pensive is for looking in the past. And I was thinking of maybe like a crystal ball for looking into the future.
Speaking of future, Tally, who's sharp today, says, don't you mean two future Hall of Famers on their blue line? Yeah, I guess so. It'll take a while for Pronger to get there. But yes, Tally. And I appreciate that you're listening very closely today.
I don't know. Did he kiss the right asses? How long will it take him to get in? That's the real question.
Who, Pronger? When does his contract end? Because he can't retire yet. That's the only thing that sucks about what's happening with Chris Pronger. He's got to wait till the contract is done and then add 3 years and then go to the Hall of Fame.
A couple other things about the lockout that I wrote down that I wanted to harken back to. Replacement players. It's funny about replacement players. I think we all agree that the thing we want to pay and the thing that we want to see are National Hockey League players playing National Hockey League hockey. But
I don't think they would have gone that route. Do you?
There's a little part of us in the back of our minds that would have loved to have seen lines of our friends wrapped around the corner at offices around North America. Remember Joe, your friend from high school? Oh boy, he had a wicked slap shot back in Bantam. Oh man. Oh, where he is. He's on line to become a New York Ranger. I mean,
right. He's
there was a part of me
first line left
like,
winger of the Philadelphia Flyers.
Oh, God. And I know it would have been terrible hockey and stupid hockey, and everybody remembers the NFL. And if you haven't, go see The Replacements, where Keanu Reeves played Shane Falco and Gene Hackman was his coach, the whole thing. But there's a part of you that probably had some morbid curiosity about replacement players. And then also what the reaction would have been from the NHL players to those replacement players. How many bar fights would have occurred in local towns when, oh, look, Chris Chelios just walked in, and there's the replacement players for the Red Wings all having a nosh.
Yeah, I wonder which players would have actually done it. Right, like if you're a player who's on the bubble, who may be an NHLer, but is playing in the American League when the lockout was on, and you get an opportunity to play in the NHL as a replacement player, but you know that, you know what, probably in a couple of years I'll make it to the NHL. Do you say yes? You know the lockout's going to end at some point, and the quote-unquote real players are coming back. Do you take that chance? I would say no, that you don't. You know what? We have Bruce Dobigan on the line.
Hey, Bruce.
Hello.
Greg and Jeff. Hello.
Hello, sir. There we go.
In the land of snow and honey in Western Canada.
Yeah, what's happening? So last year at the seminar, the NHL seminar at Rogers, I'm reading all these tweets and getting all these texts from my friends in Alberta, specifically Calgary, and they all have the same pictures. Their daughter's making snowmen in the backyard. What's going on out there, Bruce?
Well, it was Sunday, and I played golf with 26, and on Tuesday we had 6 inches of snow, and then on Wednesday we had a foot of snow. And then by Saturday,
insane.
We were golfing, and it was 22 degrees again. When you live on the now, side of a mountain, that's what happens.
Yeah. Did you see the horsemen in the sky at any point, Bruce? Any horsemen sighting? Any horsemen sightings in the sky?
No, but the raining of frogs and blood is just about any day now. Here, so.
Well, sounds like a typical day in Alberta, actually. But,
well, certainly if
you're reminiscing...
If you believe Neil Young about Alberta, yeah, we could be having a plague any day now.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah.
We are reminiscing about the 2004-2005 lockout, Bruce. It was a dark time for the National Hockey League and the Players Association. What's your recollection? What's your takeaway? Either in hindsight or at the time, what do you remember most about the lockout?
Well, I suppose if somebody asked me to say what was the biggest takeaway from the lockout, obviously getting the salary cap had to be the biggest one. They broke the union, they broke Bob Goodnow's hold over the union, and they got the salary cap. And in getting the salary cap, the way they got the salary cap, getting Trevor Linden to basically cave for the salary cap, guaranteed that we were going to have another lockout. Because the owners saw that, okay, all we have to do is put their feet to the fire for an extended period of time and they'll collapse. So, to me, those are the two big takeaways. The salary cap, which has completely changed hockey, I think, and then the effect it had on the next lockout, which it got the owners, gave the owners confidence that all they had to do was lock the players out and they'd cave.
Yeah. But weren't the marching orders twofold? One, yes, get us a salary cap, but also bring us the head of Bob Goodnow?
Exactly. Well, I mean, Goodnow went to the players, and listen, he didn't sugarcoat it. He said, this is going to last 18 months to 2 years probably because they want the salary cap, and that's how long we're going to have to hold out before they realize that that we're serious. And Goodnow had, as I said in my book, Money Players, Goodnow had beaten them at every juncture since the previous lockout. I mean, he'd taken the previous CBA, and he and Ian Pulver had made it work for them with arbitration. They'd done a whole bunch of things with agents who had hammered deals like the Bobby Holik deal, et cetera. And by the end of it, that was it. It was get rid of Bob Goodnow, or more specifically, get rid of the Bob Goodnow influence in the union. And they successfully did that because, you know, the intervening years at the union, they had three different guys who were in there, and it was a mess.
You know, there was a subtle sort of underpinning to all that too, with the removal of the Players Association's executive director, in that it very much turned agent versus agent, and it became pretty clear that there were a couple of different camps. You know, there was Camp Don Meehan, there was Camp Rich Winter. How much of that behind the scenes squabbling, fighting, backstabbing within the agent's realm led to the removal of Bob Goodnow and the acceptance of a salary cap, Bruce?
I think the rivalry between the agents was always there, had been there, and still is there, and it is a factor every day. But I think the most important thing was that the Newport Sports guys, if you look at them, there was Jerome McGinley, there was Trevor Linden, and a couple of other guys, basically went behind the union's back to negotiate with their owners, to talk with their owners about getting a settlement. And it caused a schism in the union. It certainly caused a schism among the agent ranks. Bob Goodnow was none too pleased with it. Obviously, he saw it as a play to undermine his authority. And at the end of the day, I suppose you'd have to say the Newport philosophy. There were other people as well, but Newport certainly, as a prominent agency, was the most prominent of them. But so at the end of the day, you have to say that they kind of had the greatest influence on the lockout.
You know, can I pause on one thing? I want to make one point here, and I'm not sure if I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I think, Bruce, you and I have talked about this before. There's always been I've always felt a real unease at the old title of president of the Players Association, not by way of what that person is supposed to do, but what happens to that person when they retire and when they leave the game. I'm going to read you a list of former presidents of the Players Association. How many of these...
Here.
Yeah. How many of these people receive prominent roles in the NHL post-retirement? All right. Ted Lindsay, Bob Pulford, Ken Dryden, Pitt Martin, Bobby Clark, Phil Esposito, Brian Trottier, Doug Wilson, Mike Gartner, and Trevor Linden, who was the last one they eliminated that position afterwards. Does that not give you sort of a cause for reflection when, you know, here's a former president of the Players Association, when their position is over in the PA, there's some plum jobs waiting for them in the NHL.
And let's not forget that Brendan Shanahan was a big guy in the PA for a fair bit of time, too. He was another guy who's
absolutely
now sort of landed in Clover. I think one of the reasons is the dysfunction in the union. Certainly in the Al Eagleson era, they were a house union. They were considered a branch of the NHL anyhow. And so Al would always tell these guys, yeah, I'll make sure I put in a good word for you, because you guys know hockey players. Their biggest concern is always, what am I going to do after I retire? And Al was basically promising them a conduit into management on the other side. I think one other factor that in the post-Al era, when Goodnow and some of those guys were in there, is it has been a thankless task. I mean, nobody comes up and shakes your hand and says, boy, thanks for taking this on. Thanks for all the work you've done. And I think a lot of the guys have left being the president of the PA, have left embittered. And one of the expressions of their embitterment is the fact that they're willing to cross the aisle to become management. It certainly is a point. If you talk to some of these guys, I know Trevor felt completely, you know, after it was over being the president and whatever you thought of what he did, he certainly didn't get a lot of plaudits and he was heavily criticized. And you can see him saying, well, to heck with players from now on. They can go help themselves. I'm going to take care of myself. I mean, listen, it's amazing. I'm rereading Marvin Miller's book, and none of this would have ever happened in baseball, but it's amazing that Mike Gillis, who was one of the killer agents who negotiated some of the hardest deals that the NHL had to swallow, then went over and was management, and nobody really blinked, you know? It's always been the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I would never accuse Mike of being a Quisling kind of guy in any way, shape, or form.
Were you surprised how the league bounced back? Like, when this whole thing was said and done, that February of 2005, I think it was February, or it was later than that, were you shocked how the league bounced back, or were you one of these guys that thought it was going to take a good portion of time before the fans came back, before the game recovered?
This is 0405?
Yeah, 0405. Yeah.
Or the recent lockout? 0405?
I'm sorry. Yeah, 0405, yeah.
I don't know why I was surprised by it. A few things helped. The dollar rebounded, and the Canadian fans, just whatever reasons, you know, they missed their hockey so much, they spent like crazy coming out of it. The other thing was that they also started to catch the updraft in terms of TV rights. And TV rights started to get valuable for a lot of reasons, which we've talked about in the past, Jeff. This idea that pro sports is the last vestige of live television that anyone will watch with the commercials in it. And so they also
PVR proof.
Yeah, they caught the updraft of that. So in some senses, I'm not surprised. All sports have seemingly done very well, or seemingly did well in the 20 aughts, whatever you call that decade. And I think the communications revolution was a large part of it. There's a lot of money coming into it. And, even in the American cities where people loved hockey, they really missed it and they were really happy to come back. And then I think another thing that came back is that we saw coming out of the lockout is we started to see real hockey markets starting to win the Stanley Cup again. You know, we'd had the Tampa Bays and we'd had the Carolinas and people like that. We all of a sudden saw the Detroits and Chicagos and people like that start to win again. And I think that's also an important point. Those are heritage franchises. They have fans everywhere, and I think that mattered too.
An entire season slaughtered to get a salary cap and remove Bob Goodnow as the executive director of the Players Association. As we look back on it now, 10 years later, was it worth it if you're the NHL? And was it worth it if you're the Players Association? Or should they have just read the tea leaves and said, you know what, the earlier we fold, the more money we keep in our jeans?
Again, on the folding thing, I know a lot of people say, well, look, you know, they all made great money. There were still great contracts after the 04-05 lockout. The worst thing, as they say, was the fact that Trevor and those guys caved, because it guaranteed you were going to get another test of wills, which would probably end up being in another lockout. So that I think, you know, really hurt the Players Association. I think the league did fine. I think it's more the impact. I think we're going to see the impact of salary cap more out of the last lockout. And one of the reasons I say that is just the length of this lockout. We're not mm-hmm. going to have a chance to correct any mistakes. And I think there's some huge problems in this CBA going forward. And we're not going to have a chance to do those because any side has an opt out. And we're going to be stuck with this thing for a good long time. And, you know, the point that I make about the salary cap now is that, I think most people in the league understand that the way the salary cap works and the way the league is working right now, you're either one of the top eight teams in the league or you want to be at the bottom trying to get those top draft picks. Nobody's winning Stanley Cups without having a shot at the very best talent in the draft. I mean, if you look at the four teams in the semifinals last year, they were all teams that had a shot at people, multiple years probably had a shot at people at the top of the draft. And I think that as we get even further and further into this CBA, more and more teams and player fans are going to start realizing the same thing. Like, what's the point of being 18th? What's the point of being stuck in 15th to 18th and drafting there all the time? You just can't budge out of it. And again, the NHL has no out for this CBA. They're going to be stuck with this thing. And I think we could see a whole lot of teams doing the let's try very hard but not win very often thing.
Gary Bettman in 2005 versus Gary Bettman in 2014. I think the man's reputation has been mended a little bit, but what do you think about that aspect of the lockout? Gary Bettman was probably the least popular man in Canada in 2005. I don't know if you could say the same thing today.
Well, I think he's the least popular guy in Canada in the previous lockout, too. He's never been a popular guy because he's doing the owner's bidding. He is the owner's guy, and the owners want the league run in a certain way, and Gary's made sure he did that, and he's gone to great lengths. He had a real tough optics with the Phoenix deal, where there was a chance that team could move to Hamilton, the Balsillie thing. Whatever you thought of Jim Balsillie, a lot of Canadian hockey fans thought that Gary Bettman was getting in the way of another Canadian city getting into the NHL, et cetera. And I think some time has gone by, and I think, you know, the stumbling of Roger Goodell has made Gary Bettman look good by comparison. I think for a commissioner for a quote-unquote franchise expansion type league, I think Gary's done a good job. I think the NHL's problem is that we are now keying out of that kind of economy. The idea of having more teams rather than fewer teams. I think soccer is showing us that you want to have fewer teams with the stars on them. You want to have greater TV product, etc. And I don't see him understanding that business is going that way. With all the talk about expansion to Vegas or Seattle or Quebec City or wherever, you know, Temiskaming, wherever the heck he says he's going next, I think that's going to be a huge mistake for the league. I think they have to concentrate their stars on the particular teams that they have right now. And I don't think Gary and the coterie of owners who support him understand that.
You know, normally when you start to see the clubhouse and, you know, you're Gary Bettman, you say to yourself, okay, the 100-year anniversary is on the horizon. I want to be there for that. But you're starting to think about, when am I going to wind this down? Normally people try to write a legacy or have a couple of legacy positions. You know, we see it in the Ontario Hockey League with Dave Branch specifically, and some of the legacy positions he started to put forward that will, you know, forever be attached to his name. Do you see Gary trying to write a legacy here, or has he already done it through CBAs and lockouts?
Well, we haven't had lunch lately or any heart-to-heart conversations on the phone, so I can't profess to know the man's heart from having personally talked to him. But I would bet you that if we have this conversation in 5 years, that we will say that Gary Bettman's last act, his last gift to the owners, is going to be expansion to Southern Ontario and Seattle. I think he's going to try and deliver $1 billion to the owners of this league through expansion, and that will be his sayonara and go off into the sunset. So if you're looking at a scenario that if he's planning a scenario, I think that would be it.
And finally for me, Bruce, and thanks for joining us today. Switching gears, NHL's the NHL's property on HBO, their 24/7 property, goes from HBO to a network called Epix. Which doesn't really affect you guys up there too much because you got it on Sportsnet. But down here, it's pretty big news to go from HBO to a network that most people have never heard of. I see this as Gary doing the OLN thing all over again and picking a dance partner that loves him but that nobody really knows and doesn't have the same carriage. What were your thoughts when you heard 24/7 wasn't coming back to HBO?
I don't think that the HBO thing is comparable to the ESPN thing, for instance. I don't think there was particular bitterness. I think HBO just felt like it had run its course and it didn't see where the series was going to go in the future. And Gary wants it to give it two or three or more stabs, etc. So he had to go and find some place to put it on. I think in the era of, you know, multiple showings and being able to find shows on other channels, not just other channels, but on the Netflix and other availabilities, I think it's not as bad as it was when they did the Sports Channel America and those kinds of things, where you only had the one place to go, and if your cable carrier didn't carry it, you were hooped. I think the availability of the shows now is a little bit better. I would agree with HBO. I think the last couple of years have not been particularly good. It's been okay if you're a diehard hockey fan, but nothing kind of ever got up off the floor and yelled at you that this is great TV. I'll be interested to see just what they can do to get the product going, because it's clear that a lot of people in management don't want to do it, don't want to have it. And even when they do have it, they don't seem particularly inspired. So maybe going away and refining this thing in a place where a lot of people don't see it for a year or two might be the best thing.
Last year, Bruce, what's up with the new books? Team up for us.
Well, I just got my copies of Ice Storm, the rise and fall of the greatest Vancouver Canuck team ever. And that's in, nice. I guess you'll be able to get that online in bookstores probably in the next 10 days. And then Grant Fuhr's awesome. Book, Grant Fuhr's biography, will be out at the end of this month, that I did with Grant. And I'm very proud of it. And I think it's a very honest portrayal. Grant is very honest about his life. He doesn't try to hide anything. And it's a great story from beginning to end, so I was really happy to be attached to it.
Can I ask you a quick question about Grant?
Yes.
I'm not sure if you addressed it in the book or not, but when he was in St. Louis, you remember that? Like, it was like 3 or 4 days where they couldn't find him? This would have been like 1994? He just vanished.
He signed in St. Louis in 95. He had been in L.A. He was traded to L.A. for half a season, and then he signed with St. Louis as a free agent.
It was 95. Yeah, he went like missing for like 3 or 4 days.
If it's the one thing I think you're talking about, that was when Mike Keenan sent him home, because of course Keenan had gotten rid of Curtis Joseph, told everybody he didn't want him anymore because he was out of shape, and then Grant showed up looking like the Michelin man, and Keenan blew a gasket and sent him home. And Grant disappeared for a few days, and it turned out he was golfing in Boston at the same time as the Blues were playing an exhibition game in Boston, and Keenan found out about it and blew up about it. And Grant just, you know Grant. Well, yeah.
I know, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He basically said, "Yeah, I guess it wasn't something I should have done." He said, "But it helped bring things to a head." He said, "Mike ordered me back to St. Louis because up until then, Mike didn't even want him in St. Louis." So he went on the lam for a few days and got serious about it. And of course, in St. Louis is where he met Bobby Kersey, and that's when he really seriously got into shape for playing. And the St. Louis experience, most people don't talk about it. Everyone concentrates on Edmonton, but in its own way, it's as remarkable, maybe more remarkable, I think, than the Edmonton years.
100%. And if you can indulge me, one more question. I swear this is my last one about Grant before we have you back on and talk about the book. Whose idea was it? Was it the agents? Was it Grant's to come up with the idea of selling his pads to Pepsi, to put the Pepsi cans on the pads?
That was Rich Winter. That was
Rich Winter. Okay.
Those are the days when Rich was trying to take over the union from Bob, from Al Eagleson. And he had listen, it was a great idea. There were all sorts of unexploited promotional ideas. And Rich is nothing but an idea man. He's not always a follow-up man, but he's always a great idea guy. And he came up with this idea. And, of course, they got into a big fight with Sather over it. And Sather basically explained, I can't do that. I can't put those on there because it's against the league rules. But somehow Rich felt that maybe they could get around the rules somehow. And it was a big fight. And if you remember the great scene, speaking of golf, there's Grant and Rich Winter sitting in a golf cart in Edmonton. He's 26, 27 years old, retiring from hockey over all this stuff. And Rich got into a shoving match with Glenn Sather. I don't think anyone threw a punch, but there was some tearing of clothes and some shoving, et cetera, involved in those negotiations. It was pretty bitter.
The good old days. We got to have you back on to talk some Grant Fuhr stories.
Wonder if his cigar fell out when he was scrapping with Grant Fuhr.
In those days, Slats could light his cigar. Nowadays, he's not allowed to light his cigar. Either his doctors or the people who run the buildings that he's in tell him he can't light the cigar. Yeah. In those days, he had it lit all the time.
Bruce, as someone who has just relocated to New York City, I can guarantee you it's the building. There's no place in this city to smoke a cigar. It's the worst. All right, man. Thanks for joining us. Bruce. We will have you back on to talk about the books next time, sir.
All right, there he goes.
There you go.
Bruce Dobigan. There we go. All right, thanks, Bruce. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks, Bruce. Bye.
The Grant Fuhr, I've been waiting for someone to write the Grant Fuhr book for a while because he is one of the more fascinating characters coming out of that Oilers organization, which is flooded with, you know, the Gretzky's and the Messiers and Anderson and right down the Kevin Lowe's, right down the list.
Totally.
But Bruce is right. The St. Louis era for Grant, to me, in a lot of ways, was more intriguing and, let's just say, more controversial than what happened in Edmonton. I'm not sure that all the Edmonton stories can be told, to be quite frank.
Oh, no, I don't think that he'll be able to tell all the stories. I think you'd probably have to read between the lines.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. What's the matter?
Wow.
I meant, like, line changes like hockey.
Yeah, that's right.
It snows in Edmonton.
Bitterly, 12 months a year.
So the NHL leaves HBO. I wanted to touch on this before the end of the show, and the question of the day, of course, was what network should they have gone to instead of Epix? Couple things I've learned about this deal in the last 24 hours since Scotty Burnside broke the story. The most interesting is that so on Epix they're doing two series. They're doing a 24/7, we'll call it that. It's not going to be called that, but that'll be the shorthand. They're doing a 24/7 leading up to the Winter Classic, and they're doing a 24/7 leading up to the Stadium Series game between the Sharks and the Kings. The interesting thing is that HBO wanted to only do one series. They only wanted to do the Sharks and Kings. They didn't care about the Blackhawks and the Capitals.
What?
And
really?
Yeah, right. That's the thing I found out. So that put the NHL in a really interesting spot, which is that, yes, it would be fantastic to put the spotlight on the Kings and the Sharks and have them be in a 24/7 type format. All of these amazing personalities on both of those teams, Joe Thornton with the camera on him. I mean, the whole thing would be fantastic, but it would throw the whole thing out of whack. Now all of a sudden you have 24/7 focusing on the Stadium Series instead of the Winter Classic, and the NHL has taken great pains to make sure that the Winter Classic is still a special pretty unicorn on New Year's Day. So they decided that that's not what they wanted to do. HBO was kind of insistent on it.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Ignorant Canadian over here in the corner. Hello, Mr. American.
Hello.
What's Epix?
Okay. Get to that in one sec.
All right.
The other thing I learned is that HBO and the NHL partnered financially on the first season of 24/7. HBO ducked out the next two seasons. They didn't financially support the show. They were merely the platform on which the show was broadcast under the banner of their ongoing series of 24/7 shows. It was the very network that partners on this podcast that facilitated 24/7 Rogers. Picked up some of the freight for seasons 2 and 3 of 24/7. So that was kind of interesting. Epix is... Okay, so here's Epix. Epix is the network that if you're flipping through your channels and your cable guide and you see that Marvel's The Avengers is playing and you get very excited because you love Iron Man and you want to watch the show and you go to it and you hit enter and then the message comes on your screen that says, you can't watch this movie because you're not subscribed to this network. That's Epix. They're basically known for about three or four blockbuster films, a large library of films from Paramount and Lionsgate and MGM, and they won the bidding war for the Avengers. They're trying to get into original programming. It's not worked out yet. The comparison I draw is when the NHL decided to do the Outdoor Life Network thing.
Yeah.
It's very reminiscent of that for me, where they're picking a network that loves them, that will give them carte blanche, that will pay for their programming in the sense that Burnside reported the budget for each episode is $400,000, which is a lot of money to spend on reality TV. And I imagine Epix is picking up a good portion of that freight. But more importantly for Epix, they're not a network that's available everywhere. Comcast.
How much coverage do they have across the United States?
They've got 50 million homes. And you can get them online. They're on demand. There are ways to get their programming. But they're not covered. They're not carried by Comcast, which is, of course, the company that has a $2 billion television contract with the NHL.
Mm-hmm.
They're not covered by, I believe it's DirecTV, I want to say. Doesn't have a deal with them. One of the two major satellite companies doesn't have a deal with them. So they're not everywhere. And it's a way for them to activate the NHL fans to call their local cable provider and demand that they get Epix on their networks. So it's a very handy way to try to force the hand of some cable companies that are sitting out to try to get Epics, or else people can't see 24/7. There was a note in Burnside's story that said that they're going to make the show available. I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means you pay to stream it. I don't know if that means that you, you know, will get it after this the four episode run. You can find a way to get them on demand. I don't know, but it's a pretty interesting move. I mean, the HBO thing was akin to the ESPN thing. It was prestigious to be on the show. I thought if they took the property away from HBO, the owners wanted to bring it to a wider audience instead of a subscription based audience, but they didn't do that. They brought it to even a smaller audience. So I imagine that Epix is ponying up a pretty good amount of cash to produce this show, and they were willing to do both the Stadium Series game and the Winter Classic.
JKR Devil tweets in, a lot of Epix programming is available on Netflix as well.
Okay. So maybe there's a Netflix component to that too. It'll go to Netflix next. Netflix was a place that people in the QOD it's DirecTV that doesn't carry Epix, by the way. A lot of people were in the QOD said, what about Netflix for this? And that would have been a very interesting fit. And not a bad one at all. A lot of people were saying, what about YouTube? Because we are in a different world now. And wouldn't it be exciting to just have that stuff on YouTube? And that's an interesting call as well. I imagine it's because Epix ponied up and decided to cut a pretty friendly financial deal with the NHL. John Roberts writes, and Epix does a lot of original stand-up specials. That's true. They've had Jim Norton. They've had a few others. But this is by no means a network that is known for its original content, be it sports,
by the way,
or anything else.
Pause on Jim Norton. Have you seen his online show?
No, what online show?
Do yourself the favor.
I'm a big Jim Norton's show. Opie and not more any more Anthony fan. I love Jim Norton too. I think he's brilliant.
He's freaking brilliant. He is. His talk show is brilliant too.
He doesn't like sports though. He's one of those guys that I wish there was a way to get him on. We can't get him on because he doesn't like sports.
Yeah, it's like trying to get Doug Stanhope on. It's like, yeah, well, good luck. Do what? Talk about cigarettes?
Frank Fala... shut up.
Hang on. Are we having audio problems? Got a couple of tweets here. One from Peter F. saying, do you have sound issues or is my stuff broken? Seabass, a.k.a. Sebastian, here too. All my audio from everything else is fine.
Huh, weird.
Anybody else having sound problems?
Let us know.
You sound good to me right now. You sound good you sound good today.
Frank F. writes in, no one. They have the NHL Network. Want to grow your own channel, produce great content. But Epix is going to allow them to produce the show unfiltered. Well, let me rephrase that. With profanities. We say uncensored, but it's very censored and it's very filtered. It's a reality show that's edited for your pleasure. It's not raw footage, let's be honest here. But Epix will allow it to have the profanities and stuff that we all love to listen to.
The swears.
The swear words.
And you get the
swear
hockey. And you get the swears, yeah. They swear
Scott Huntington writes in, what about HGTV? Narrator, will the happy couple choose to play at the amazingly perfect Camden Yards, the under-budget fantastic Chicago locations, or the boringly average Nationals Park? That's so true.
Is that it? I would have loved Camden Yards, but just because I love that. I mean, I've never gone, but I've always wanted to go to Camden Yards.
Oh, I rallied hard for Camden Yards, but there's a lot of local politics here with D.C. and Baltimore that can't happen.
By the way, Jim Norton's show, according to John, is on Vice. Yes, it is. And Hannah submits, you are having audio problems.
Oh,
damn it.
All right. We apologize for the audio problems.
Sorry, we make bad sounds today.
We make bad sounds. A couple of people have mentioned the Spice Network, which I'm not even sure exists anymore. Sam England writes in the Spice Network. Do you know what the Spice Network is, Merrick?
No, what's that?
What do you think it would be?
It would be like the 50 Shades of TV.
it's the porno network.
Oh, is it? It's the Jiggle Network?
The great thing about Spice, and anybody who is of my age and in his 30s, just leave it at that. I'm catching up to you, Merrick. Spice Network, of course, will mean something to you because back in the day before they had the thing where if you didn't get a station, it would default to a screen that says, here's how you get the station. When you went to a station you didn't have, it just would be a broken up signal. Just wavy lines.
Right.
So anybody who had cable, who had Spice, if you were probably a boy, I'm not trying to leave the girls out of this one, but it's a boy thing, I think, for the most part. Mm-hmm. You tuned into Spice and waited and waited and waited to see if you could see a boob.
Right.
Or anything.
The and then beat it like it owed you money. That was it.
It was like, I mean, it is, I say if you're in your 30s, because it is that it's the pre-internet generation.
Oh, man.
That also had cable stations that had wavy lines. It's a very specific demographic, but you would hear the audio from the porno, and then you would stare at the screen in the hopes that something
hilarious,
even resembling a breast. It's very possible
you kids,
that
it could have
been like Vern Troyer's head and not a breast. But like,
oh,
could,
God. Oh, man. Oh, man. Oh, that is just such a terrible. Hey, you kids have it easy today. I mean, all your porn's simple to get. Back when Greg and I were young, we had to work for Lexi and Paul Goffberg both send in that it sounds fine. You're coming in loud and clear. So I don't know. I don't know.
They hear double audio. Maybe that's my new apartment. Maybe it sounds like there's an echo.
Matt says, no problems here. Peter F. saying, yeah, switches from stereo to mono every other minute.
Look, I need to, I just can't, I'm just going to say this once.
Look, hang on. Okay. I'm in stereo and Greg has mono. That's why.
I'm going to say this once to you people. You've heard the show long enough to know that things could be worse. Neither one of us sound like a Dalek. Both of us have been on the show for the entirety of the hour.
For a freaking hour, I know.
I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. There's an echo. Echo, echo, echo. It could be worse, okay? Listen. What were you going to say?
Nothing. It sounds like an old Who album. You want to talk about a big echo.
Ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow.
Boys and girls. Children of all ages.
Tomorrow, we're going to announce what's going to happen on Sunday.
It's going to be epic. It's going to be epics.
We do have an epics show on Sunday. And when I say show, I mean show. It sounds like we're going to do a show Sunday.
Look out. Where, and Greg? Where are we going to do a show?
Well, we haven't closed the deal yet. It's going to
tell
be
me,
in Toronto.
Buddy.
It's
going to
be somewhere
tell
on
me, little buddy.
Bloor Street? Was that
yeah, Bloor a little bit east of Ossington, near Christie Pit. So like Bloor and Christie area.
We're going to announce the venue tomorrow. The only downside is that it's going to be kind of the audience will be capped at a number.
The only downside is you and I have to pay for the room. That's it. We have to get into our own jeans and finally spend our communion money.
We've worked on that.
Oh, man.
So tomorrow we will reveal where the live MVSW will be held and how you could be a part of it. But block out 6 o'clock Sunday for the tail end of the NFL 4 o'clock games, and the live podcast will do. And then the great thing about the room is that we'll have it afterwards too for a little, you know, meet and greet mixer, social happy hour, what have you. So tomorrow will be the details. We'll let you know about it. But Sunday, 6 o'clock, just make sure that you leave
West
it open.
West End of Toronto.
Yep.
Location,
and then we'll go from there.
TBA. Who's coming down from Yahoo? I was direct messaging with Jen last night. She's coming in on Sunday. So
Jen
she's
will
coming
be there.
So Jen Neal's
Jen
coming.
Jen will be there. Leahy will be there. I will be there. Nice. Nick will be there. We have a meetings at Yahoo on Monday and Tuesday, our annual hockey meetings. So I'll be in town beginning on Saturday. I'm going to go to Buffalo Sabres camp on Saturday during the day and then drive to Toronto that evening. Why go to Buffalo Sabres camp, you ask? Because I am fucking fascinated by that team. I don't know about you.
Is Connor McDavid skating with them yet? She started skating with the team yet?
He's on a tryout contract.
Okay, he's on
speaking of which, PTO. Speaking of which,
the,
by the way,
Sabres.
Are the Devils just inviting everyone who ever played in the NHL to their camp?
Yeah, that's right. Everybody, come on along. Thomas Cabrera, Scott Gomez, yeah, everyone, come on down.
Gomez, Cabrera, Fedotenko. Mm-hmm. There's more that I'm missing. There's even Komisarek just was invited.
Oh, I missed that one. Is Komisarek going too?
Yeah.
And they just signed Eric Jelinek. So the defense looks like it's. Are they done? They don't have anyone to sign on the blue line,
do they? The defense should be set. That's why the Cabrera and Komisarek things have me so nervous, because one of the problems with the Devils last year was DeBoer burying the kids in favor of the vets. And right now you've got Salvador, Green, and then Merrill, Jelinek, and Larson.
But Peter Harreld.
Peter Harreld. And so maybe they're looking to, I mean, you know, maybe Harold's, I guess they're looking for another regular.
Now, Santini's going back to Boston College, right?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't missed that. He's going back to BC. What about Damon Severson, the kid from Kelowna? Because wasn't he close to making the team last year? Didn't Severson almost make that team?
Well, I think that your kid contingent is Jelena, Merrill, and Larson. And now it's just going to be a matter of how much ice time they get. Because good Lord, man. Like, what I mean, Volchenkov leaving is going to open up some ice time. Fane leaving is going to open up some ice time. They got to give those kids more ice time. They're all really good.
Hang on. Here's a question for you. How many forwards on the Devils? I don't know off the top of my head. You know the lineup better than I do. How many Devils forwards are under 30? Four? Maybe four?
I would say probably about five or six. But you have to keep in mind that right now, the Devils have 155 forwards.
Like, jeez. Is anybody under 30 on this team? Adam Henrique and Travis Zajac.
Havlik, Henrique, Jager, Zajac, Eliash, Klo, Ryder, Camilleri.
Keep going, bud.
The Zubras. Zubras. Oh, yeah.
Michael Ryder. Keep going, dude.
Yeah. then up front, Gomez is in camp. Cam Jansen. They literally have like 155 forwards in camp. This camp, I don't even know where they're going to hold. They're going to hold it in Giant Stadium. And all the players they have in camp will sit in the seats waiting for their turn on the ice.
Oh,
it's insane.
Man.
It's insane how many people the Devils have in camp.
And they're all old. And they're all old.
Hey, Ron, we're going to make
kids.
One more run at it. None of these kids are going to muck up the works.
Yeah, Reed Boucher, no room for you. Sorry, too young. Still behind you.
Hey, you.
Matteau, Matteau, go back. No room for you.
Hey, Cabalet, how old are you? Perfect. Are you Czech? Perfect. You're hired.
All right, dude. Listen, you got to go, and I got to go. Oh, Zdlicky, that's right. Michael Palmer, so you got Zdlicky, Green, Salvador, Harold, Merrill, Jelena, and Larson, and Cabrillet, and Komisarek. So really, you're doing, I don't know.
You got me, bud. I mean, listen, there's always going to be injuries.
Devils roster right now is like when my daughter spills all of her magnetic letters on the floor and then starts putting up words that are nonsense. XK5L313CAT. That's the lineup right now.
Like when I give my son my iPhone and say, hey, send a text to mom. And what comes out looks like what the Devils have right now
looks
in camp.
Looks like I've fallen asleep on the keyboard at 2:30 in the morning doing three stars. That's what it looks like. Hey, and one more thing for you Puck Daddy readers. Just to tease it out a little bit. I think it's going to happen, but I can't say for sure yet because the ink's not dry. Might be a couple new additions to the Puck Daddy family in the near
future.
I can't go into it. I'm not going into it.
What? Come on, you can tell me. Buddy, pal.
I refuse to. Not until the ink is dry on these deals.
Dude, these million dollar deals. Dude,
I will vow this. We will sign the new Puck Daddy members before the Blue Jackets sign Ryan Johansson.
Look, dude, at this point of the podcast, nobody's listening. Nobody's listening.
Oh, good. Aces. Right?
You can just say, that's right. You can just say who it is now. Everyone's gone.
Now batting. Number
exactly.
18.
I stand before you today.
Mota. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock.
But before I go, we should mention programming note tomorrow. We're back at 2:00, although I kind of get the wish that the schedule for the podcast this season is going to be a little funky. Maybe I have to move the start time. What? It's true. Hold on for that. But tomorrow on the podcast, 2:00 Eastern, Tyler Dello. What's his title? Edmonton Oilers Consultant. Will be live in the studio with us. I think that's his actual title. Consultant.
Tyler, it's consultant to the Edmonton Oilers. all right, yeah, he's going to join us. And this is awesome because he has really not spoken too much or at all since he was hired by the Oilers. Yeah.
Although you will be able to see him on our analytics special on Sportsnet Thursday at 7 o'clock Eastern, 4 Pacific, a numbers game. Yes.
I'm sorry. I thought TSN had cornered the market on analytics.
No, sorry. They got Scott Cullen. They got Travis Yost. They got James Merrill. Actually, we just signed up a whole bunch of analytics guys at Sportsnet.ca, including my buddy Stephen Birch. So that's all good news there, too. Yeah.
The analytics.
It's analytics war. Everyone's loading up. Analytics wars. Who do you got? Who did you grab? Well, I can't wait to see if Puck Daddy hires an analytics person as well. I would assume.
Oh,
I
wonder if we will hire an analytics person. A person that does analytics.
Really?
I wonder if they will be part of the staff.
A girl who does analytics? Okay. Well, that'll be interesting. Wow. We will have to wait for that information to come out publicly. Because Greg can't say here publicly, even though
no not at all. They will be a great addition if the ink gets dry. They will be. All right, everybody.
Wow, great. If this person is listening right now, you might want to hustle along that signature.
Well, it's not on them. It's on us as usual. Oh, don't get me started on contracts. That's all we're going to say. And by the way, congratulations on Sportsnet for hiring a they as well. And by that, I mean Steve Dangle. We haven't really discussed that yet.
I know. The People's Republic of Steve Dangle is now a member of the Sportsnet family. But as I always say about my buddy Steve Dangle, he's a nice bunch of guys. Welcome aboard to Sportsnet, Steve.
I think I'm going to work at Sportsnet. Turns that sideways. Hey, I think you should go work at TSN. They pay more. No, I think Sportsnet's really the place I want to be. Maybe you should go work at the Score app. All right, that's all.
Normally when you do that, you throw a shot at Josh. I'm surprised you're as reserved as you were. You mentioned Score app.
All right. Just because I mentioned the Score app, this means a shot at Josh. I got accused of that the other day, too.
I was waiting for a shot at Josh, essentially, is what I'm saying.
Everyone knows if I was going to take a shot at anybody at the Score, it'd be Bourne for leaving Puck Daddy.
Is he going to be one of the announced names? Do you have to wait?
Bourne? Oh, no, you can't go back again. Yeah, no, you can't go back again.
Oh. Never. Oh, okay.
Yeah, this ain't I ain't Lou Lamoriello, and he ain't Scott Gomez. This ain't one and done. Wow. For everybody.
Okay. Well, all right. Okay. Pay attention.
That's true.
Hey,
that's
Leahy?
That's the rule.
Hear that? Hear that, Neil?
Yeah, you hear that, Leahy?
One and done.
It's no threat.
That's it.
Lambert, I take
that. All
right,
back. I got to go.
I mean, if he ever left. All right, we'll see you later. Bye.